I have in my hands a book that reads more like a crime thriller, really, than a description of a cameraman's adventures filming wildlife. But I guess that's what nature's all about, the prey and the predator. Does the young albatross, for instance, get away from the tiger shark as it's learning to fly? Does the eider duck escape the hungry polar bear? What about the elk being chased by a pack of wolves? I'm not really sure if a crime writer could set up such a narrative. But my last guest today has certainly captured these wild animals in action and drawn the conclusions about it. John Aitchison is a Scottish filmmaker. He's worked for the past 20 years with the likes of BBC, National Geographic and Discovery Channel. His many awards include a joint BAFTA for cinematography for the BBC's Frozen Planet. John has now swapped the camera for the pen, as it would have been in the old days, to write about some of his travels, capturing these animals on film, as well as his own adventures in doing so. The Shark and the Albatross travels with a camera to the ends of the earth is the result, and he joined me via Skype from Glasgow.
Thank you very much, Geraldine. It's lovely to be with you.
You, not only an award-winning filmmaker, you also write really very poetically. I wonder if all that time waiting for the animals you're filming to do what they're supposed to do, like move, gives your mind the time to, I don't know, really deeply observe what you're seeing and where you are?
I think sometimes it does, because there's a lot of waiting in my job. Often it's with other people and then it's a bit more difficult. But when I'm on my own, if I'm in a hide or something for 18 hours, which is quite possible, then I keep notes and I pay attention to the stuff that's going on around. And actually it makes the waiting easier as well, because of course it's mostly waiting, mostly just sitting still.
Yes, I don't know how you have the patience, but anyway, I'm delighted you do. Maybe you could even read from, it's early on in the book, from your introduction, because I don't think anybody could tell it quite as well. The young albatross is learning how to fly and the tiger shark beneath the water. Could you read a little bit for us, please?
Yeah, of course. The shark is shocking when it comes. The sea erupts. A head, four times wider than the bird, hurls it towards the sky, its wings trailing. In this liquid world, the shark is astonishingly solid, the antithesis of water, like a blade. Its eyes are blank white circles, zombie-like membranes, closed for protection as it attacks. But they mean the shark must strike blind, and it doesn't see the albatross slide sideways from its enormous head, unharmed. A triangular fin cuts past, inches away, and far taller than the bird. The tail thrashes as the shark turns to try again. The camera runs. I haven't breathed. Another lunge, and I see the shark's jaws bulging forwards through its skin as it prepares to bite. But the bird is deflected sideways by its bow wave, and again the shark misses. The albatross grasps its opportunity and runs, literally runs, scrabbling for footholds on the water and pumping its wings. It gains the air and heads out to sea, and this time it doesn't stop. The shark makes two more frantic passes, and then it's gone. Who knows how much it understands of flight? Perhaps the albatross appeared to it briefly, only to vanish again, leaving its footprints patterning the sky. There will be others in the coming days. The sharks will wait for them, and so will I. But I can be honest with myself now. I'm glad at least the first one escaped.
Look, thank you, John. I just hope that does give listeners the sense of description that you provide, but also the battle between animals. And you say we often take sides. And you ask the question, do we really have to make that choice? What are you getting at?
Well, that's why I chose that title, actually, because it seemed to me that when you watch something like that as a filmmaker or as a viewer, we tend to choose one of those two characters as our character to follow, just to empathize with. So we might be on the albatross's side, which I was because I was watching them from above and the sharks were eating them. The divers who were filming them from underneath, and they were paying attention to the sharks much more than the birds. And for them, the sharks were the heroes of that and they wanted the sharks to eat. So I thought, well, it's wrong to take sides in that situation. And what we should be doing instead, because both of these animals are threatened, and many of the animals I've seen as I travel around the world filming things are in trouble, We should be choosing between being on nature's side, on the shark and the albatross's side, or on neither. And we should do it consciously, because at the moment, much of the time, we're doing it without thinking about it, and we end up anti-nature.
There's a high degree of danger in all of this too, John. When you went to the Arctic, you just had to learn how to fire a gun. You learn about explosives to place around your tent in case a bear comes sniffing about in the middle of the night. In fact, you're told that guns are more dangerous than bears. Yes. It's a beautiful part of the book, this. Did you feel uneasy about that?
Yes. The thing about polar bears is that they are very dangerous, and they will, some individuals will hunt people on purpose. You don't go into that situation in a blasé way. And the people, very experienced people, Norwegians that I was with, were armed and equipped with ways to scare off the bears, which are mostly bangers and flares.
I read you're not allowed to go out onto the ice if you don't have a gun.
Yes. In Svalbard, yes. You're not allowed to leave the town without a gun. For self-defense, which is extraordinary, isn't it? You can go and hire a rifle in the camping shops.
God.
But they have so many bears, there are more bears there than people. And it's just something, it's a fact of life, really, in Svalbard. There are polar bears, you see them in the town sometimes, and quite often just outside the town.
Look, you have to tell the story. I know you probably told it lots of times, but the story about you and the canvas tent and the polar bear, you'll have to tell it, please.
Well, we were staying in a place where there was a cabin, but my filming is always done from very small hides, which are about a metre on each side and, I don't know, 2 metres high, a metre and a half high, something like that. And the guy who owned the cabin said, you've got to watch out for one of these bears, because there's one that I call the telephone bear, he said. So the telephone bear was not on the island when I set out to film the eider ducks that I was supposed to film. So I set up my hide. I was in the hide, and my friend Stano, who was on watch, radioed and said, quick, get out, there's a bear coming. And it was swimming. It swam to the island that we were on. So Stano came down, and we got the equipment out, and we went back to the cabin and waited by the cabin. And the bear came onto the island, and it went straight to the hide, and it put its head in at the back through where the zip is at the back of the hide, which would have been just beside my right hip if I was sitting on a stool inside it. And Stainer said, oh, that would have been exciting if you were still inside. And then it went round the front, and it stuck its head in the front, and then it just stood up on its hind legs and put its front paws on the roof of the hide and completely flattened it as if it was nothing. It could have been made of paper. Yes.
Well, I'm very glad you're here to tell the tale. I mean, in fact, you do say there are two animals, polar bear being one that you feel privileged to have spent time filming. You also cite emperor penguins from the Antarctic. Are your other favourite animal?
Yes, in the Antarctic. They're really extraordinary. They're the most extreme birds, really, of any bird. Obviously, they don't fly, which is quite extreme, but they nest in the winter in the Antarctic at minus 60 centigrade when they lay their eggs in the middle of the winter. The females put eggs on the males' feet and leave, and the males don't eat anything for 100 days while they incubate the eggs, and then the females come back. Mm. We filmed them in the summer, so the chicks were already grown quite a lot. And just being with them, living with them for 3 weeks, camping next to them on the ice. So we had 300 metres of seawater underneath a metre or so of ice that we were camping on. Hearing the lovely caroling calls that the chicks make, and then trekking out over the ice with the birds to the edge of the ice where they jump into the sea, and seeing them coming back as well, which was what we were filming, was a highlight of my whole life, really. It's one of the most amazing experiences
really?
I've ever had.
But not you say, inside your tent, as their farts are dreadful.
Yes. Well, yeah, you wouldn't. They do. They stink. They really smell bad. It must be all the fish, I think. But you wouldn't want them in your tent. Absolutely not. They're also very big.
You do, of course, write about climate change having a real impact, because as the Antarctic warms to such an extent that it now rains, and the penguin chicks, these emperor penguin chicks, aren't used to being wet or muddy, which is a lovely little, observation. You must have seen other signs of climate change on your travels.
Yes. Yeah, there are lots, sadly. Certainly it's true of penguin chicks that rain is not good for them. It's more the Adélie and chinstrap chicks that were getting muddy. But in the north, polar bears are struggling because the ice that they depend on is melting. It's the same with the penguins. They need ice too. The Adélies and emperors both need ice. And ice is melting away at both ends of the planet. So in the north, where we were filming the bears in Svalbard, some years now have so little sea ice that the bears, particularly in the south, areas are struggling to find enough to hunt seals, which is their main food. So, yeah, we film bears swimming quite long distances. I think the most extreme example I've heard is one that was collared in Alaska and then had to swim for something like 9 days. It swam about 700 kilometres. Looking for ice.
Look, I'm going to hop over. You've got some fabulous stories about tigers in India, but I'm going to hop over to wolves in Yellowstone Park in the US.
Yeah.
Because they've had a very fragile relationship with humans. They were made extinct in 1926, you remind me, but brought back in 1995 as the elk population exploded. And they're protected in the park, but not necessarily outside of the park. You know, their very existence, John, depends on our laws. I don't know what to make of that.
Yes, well, we've had an ambivalent relationship with wolves for a very long time, I think. Initially, I think when people were hunter-gatherers, wolves were actually seen as examples of how you could be, of being a really good, effective hunter. But as soon as we started keeping domestic animals, of course, it changed because the wolves were competitors and they wanted to eat our cows and sheep. So in Europe, they're coming back and in some places they're being welcomed. In the States, they are starting to cross from Canada, but in Yellowstone, they were deliberately reintroduced, as you say. And that was done because their removal had meant that the herbivores, particularly the elk in the park, had increased in number so much that they were affecting other things. So as an ecological move, I suppose, bringing the wolves back to their natural role in Yellowstone to eat the elk was done to restore balance in the park. But of course, the wolves didn't stay in the park. So some of them go outside and ranches in the three states where Yellowstone is. That's Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho. The cattle ranchers don't like wolves at all. And the law has sort of seesawed back and forth. There have been lots of court cases about it. And at the moment, it's much worse for wolves than it was when we filmed them. It's possible to hunt wolves on all three sides now of the national park boundary. So their numbers have gone down.
How extraordinary. What a tale. That's just from 1995 onwards. Look, I just have to ask you about, because it seems to me your whole thesis is you want people to take note of the wildlife and the nature around us, but not necessarily in a sentimental way. One of your lovely memories is of New York City, high above the skyscrapers, filming the peregrine falcons. Now, how do they exist in such an urban space?
Well, that was an extraordinary experience, and it's an amazing story, I think, because there are negative stories about the environment and wild animals, but that's such a positive story, because what happened was in the 60s and 70s, there were pesticides being used that accumulated in top predators like peregrines, and they were dying out, so their numbers were right down. There were none breeding east of the Mississippi in the US. Then a few individuals decided they would do something about this, so they got DDT banned, the chemical, and they captured bred the birds and started releasing them. And they did spectacularly well in cities because there were fewer predators in cities. So the numbers soared, and now there are 17, I think even this year, 18 pairs in New York City alone in the five boroughs. So you can go into that incredibly urban place and look up, even by the Chrysler Building where we were filming, and see these the fastest birds on earth, the most extraordinary predators flying overhead, catching pigeons, plenty of food in the city, pigeons and lots of places to nest because the buildings are like cliffs, which is where they would have nested naturally.
Goodness me. That is a wonderful tale of cohabitation, isn't it, really?
I think so. I think it's inspiring because it's a thing that people have achieved on behalf of nature. And then in that quite unnatural environment, that man-made environment, it's possible to just look up and notice wild nature going about its business. And I think that's really uplifting. In fact, the ultimate example of it, I think, was after 9/11, the guy we were working with who goes and bans the birds every year was saying he volunteered to help the gangs of people who were moving rubble away by hand from where the buildings had fallen down. And he looked up out through all the smoke and the destruction, and he saw one of the peregrines flying over that nested near there. And it gave him hope because he realized that there was the possibility of renewal really coming out of this destruction.
Wow. Well, John Atchison, thank you so much for telling us all that and putting yourself through all that patient watching. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure. You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
And John Atchison's book is The Shark and the Albatross, Travels with a Camera to the Ends of the Earth. It's a profile book publication. He joined me via Skype from his home in Glasgow, where you could hear all the household noises.